Australia's highest ranking Catholic is in jail. George Pell's conviction on 5 child sex offences sent shockwaves across the globe.
We don't want to put the victim now on trial by suggesting that somehow maybe what they said was wrong.
A media frenzy. The conviction gave rise to 2 camps, those accepting the verdict and those who questioned it.
If we are too quick to judge, we can end up joining the demonisers or the apologists, those baying for blood or those in denial.
I have serious misgivings about this verdict. I just can't accept it based on what I consider is the overwhelming evidence of this trial.
Pell was a conservative martyr, they said, hated for his opinions and his senior position in the church. Their defence of Pell, an attack on the verdict, hurt his victims and their families, who have for so long struggled to find justice, with some pointing out it was Pell that was on trial, not his victims.
For too long in the Catholic Church, people who were abused weren't believed. They were actively silenced.
And I'm quite surprised and distressed that people like John Howard are running this type of commentary and providing support publicly for Cardinal Pell following his conviction.
I think once a person is convicted of pedophilia and you stand up and say, well, he's my mate and I'm no fair-weather friend and I'm sticking with him, what are you saying to the victims? Now, that's just not good enough.
The case also shone a light on the suppression orders that stopped Australian journalists reporting the verdict until about 2 months after it had been handed down. For years, the public has known the church covered up priests abusing parishioners and moved them around to avoid scrutiny. With such a senior member of the clergy now convicted, the future of the Australian Catholic Church is in jeopardy. This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. This week, the fury and fallout of George Pell's conviction on child sex offences. Joining us on the panel today is the editor of The Age, Alex Lavelle. Alex, welcome to Please Explain for the first time.
Thank you, Tori.
Also for the first time joining us is senior crime writer John Sylvester.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. Later on, we'll chat to ABC investigative journalist Louise Milligan, who describes her experience both reporting on the Pell case and finding herself in the witness box. But first, Alex, to you. In your time as editor of The Age, where does this story rank for its challenges and stakes for you and the newspaper?
So, Tori, I've been editor for two and a half years now, and I would say that genuinely this has been the hardest and toughest but also most interesting story that I've had to deal with as editor for several reasons. The suppression order attached to the case, the moral dilemmas we've had about how to cover it, the different viewpoints, the real passion of those people who have different viewpoints, the material involved in that it obviously involves this horrendous abuse in the Catholic Church in particular that goes back decades. So it's been, I would say, the biggest challenge. It's been really emotional. There's been lots of really intense conversations about it. There are lots of important, challenging stories that I've done and been involved with. Most of them have been much more short term than this one. This has been a challenge for months.
It's really unusual, isn't it, for a journalist and an editor to know the facts of a story for months before they can publish it. So you actually had quite a few months to make up your mind what the editorial position on this story was, didn't you?
We did.
Did you wax and wane a lot during those months?
Well, we waxed and waned a bit during those months, but also one of the things that you see is this, even once the story is published, the pendulum has swung backwards and forwards on it as well. And so you can only plan so much. And that's one of the things that I thought was, we need to plan the basics. We need to plan the exactly how we're going to cover the story in terms of in a news sense. But I knew that once the story was out, because you can only plan so much, I knew that following the story being out, that we would then be chasing all sorts of different leads. The opinion in the public would change. There would be, I knew, some sympathetic voices, which we'd have to handle as well, as that's turned out. There'd also be once the story was out, once again, something that has gripped Melbourne for decades is this abuse in the Catholic Church. So those old scabs were going to be ripped off again. And so there's been much more general discussion about that abuse and the fallout from that and the hurt and pain from that and what will happen to the Melbourne response, the compensation payments. And it's such an emotional story that it's and it will continue on. There's obviously an appeal. There's a prospect that the original decision will be overturned. And again, that will open up a whole new Pandora's box of of issues and stories.
John, have you ever seen a story like this?
Probably no, because this is a case where, you know, there have been people who really, really wanted him to be guilty, and there are people who really wanted him to be innocent. And probably those groups were not actually looking at the facts. And I was all more interested in looking at the process, whether Pell got a fair trial. Now, we know he's a very divisive figure, and we know that he appears to be very cold, and we know that he said some extremely foolish things in relation to this area, but he was not on trial for being a fool or being cold or being aloof. He was on specific charges which required a specific standard of proof.
So Herald Sun columnist Andrew Bolt, he came out of the gates very quickly as soon as the suppression order lifted, saying that he questioned the verdict, for which he's received an enormous backlash. But you've also written about concerns raised on the evidence, as have many other commentators, and lots of legal experts who've been quoted in The Age have raised concerns about it. How do we balance in these circumstances the need to look after the victims in these cases with looking at our legal system and the way it works and upholding the law?
Andrew Bolt's a really popular and influential columnist, but he made a position when he was in Rome. He said, I've decided that he didn't do it, but effectively. And therefore, he's come from that particular position. So I think his supporters support him, and his enemies decry him. And within what he's written has been some valid points and other points that probably aren't particularly relevant, like, this is not the guy I know. That's totally irrelevant. None of us would actually know a friend if he was committing such heinous crimes. It's actually about the process. And what happened some years ago, for very reasonable reasons, we had a big move, a shift, particularly in sex crimes, and that's about uncorroborated evidence. Let's get away from Pell for a moment. In many of the cases, and virtually all the historic ones, the problem has been that the victim is uncorroborated. There's no forensics and there's usually no witness. So there has been a shift so that you can accept uncorroborated testimony.
And does that happen in any other type of crime?
To my knowledge, no. If Alex and I were to get in a punch on in private, and we both ended up with superficial injuries, and I said he started it and he said I started it, the police would say, well, we don't know.
I certainly didn't see anything.
And that's the end of it. In the sex area, it's a different thing. And we've moved to a position, which again is justified, where the complainant is usually, we come from a position of saying we believe the complainant. Now, because this particular Pell case is so emotional, people are saying you either believe Pell's version or you believe the complainant's version. And that's not true in a criminal trial. There's all that no man's land in the middle, which is called, I'm not sure.
Reasonable doubt.
I don't know. And all that property is owned by the defence. So we have Pell and we have his very expert legal team, and they cross-examine the complainant aggressively and challenge him, which is exactly what they should do. But, of course, his core allegations stay. And then the very experienced Robert Richter takes the very traditional path in defence in not allowing his client to take the witness box and give sworn testimony. Now, it's really quite usual, because what you're saying is to the Crown, prove your case. We don't have to prove it. Now, clearly, Richter and his team were satisfied. George Pell definitely wanted to give evidence.
Right.
Now, clearly, for the defence team, his performance at the Royal Commission and other places where he's been cold and has said some frankly stupid things, they would have thought, oh my God, put him in the witness box and he's a loose cannon. It's the usual way, but in hindsight, perhaps putting Pell in the box to actually say something like, I've just witnessed the complainant's testimony. Clearly, something terrible has happened to him. My heart goes out to him, but it wasn't me. I didn't leave the procession. I've never left the procession. I have never harmed a child. I've done many things in my life that I wish I hadn't, looking back on it, but I didn't do this. Maybe that would have created reasonable doubt.
It's certainly a shift that's really challenged lawyers, particularly Robert Richter. I mean, he's taken himself out of the appeal because he said he's too emotionally affected by the result. Alex, people, it's so heightened, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think there's two interesting things coming out from what John just said. One is that I, in my experience, I haven't seen a case dissected as closely as this one. And one of the interesting parts of that is that the people who are dissecting the case haven't actually heard the crucial evidence given by the victim.
So because none of us have.
None of us have. So that's one important
part
of it.
Just to clarify, did the reporters sitting in the courtroom hear it?
No, so no one heard it apart from the jury and the judge and the lawyers. So the reporters didn't hear it either. So that was one of the things I thought was interesting when our reporter there, Adam Cooper, said that there was huge shock when the verdict was announced. But the shock wasn't so much about the verdict itself, but more the magnitude of the situation. So people actually hadn't heard the crucial evidence, and a lot of the commentary around it is, they don't have the complete picture. And the other thing that I've found interesting is the character witness side of the story, where we've, Andrew Bolt's one example, but then former Prime Ministers John Howard and Tony Abbott, who both gave Tony Abbott didn't give a character witness, but he said, what he thought that George Pell was a good guy, and what he's been convicted of wasn't consistent with the character he knew. And so that one of the other debates people are having is whether you can really take people on how you know them, and whether you or whether your opinion of people is coloured by what they've done. I've had a little interesting experience with that myself, actually, where my mum, who sells Labrador puppies, she went off one day to sell one, and she came home and said that she'd sold a puppy to Augusto Pinochet when he was in the UK for a couple of years when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. And she came back and said, what a lovely guy General Pinochet seemed to be. And I said, but Mum, here's a guy who has been accused of executing 3,000 people, throwing people out of planes. And she told me, well, my experience of him is that he's great to dogs. And that was that's generally how she judges people anyway. But it's sort of interesting how you find people and whether what they may or may not have done colours that experience is another thing that I think has come out from this.
Tony Abbott's been under a lot of pressure to sort of publicly say, if the appeal is rejected, I will no longer be friends with George Pell. But that's not how life works, is it? Life's much more complicated than that, don't you think, John?
Oh, I think we're coming to the stage, just whether it's social media, we've got to take sides.
Mm.
And it's crazy. And these
I don't think we have to take sides, John.
No, I'm saying it's sad that we do. But it seems to be the way that we pile on, and you've got to have an opinion on everything, even when you don't know.
But you raise an interesting point, Tori, because the people who are at the moment backing Pell are relying on the appeal being successful. So then if the appeal's not, how that then plays out is another interesting side of it.
We'll go through it all again.
Yeah.
And the appeal's very interesting because there seems to be this sort of sense of, oh, the jury got it wrong, it'll be turned around. Well, juries, very few actually get it wrong. And the system is based on the fact that a jury is like a computer. And that is, you input the material and it will come to the right result. So most appeals, nearly all appeals, are based on the jury came to this conclusion because. the judge erred in allowing this information or disallowing that information. And in this particular case, Judge Kidd is a very experienced judge, and both the prosecution and defence during the trial thought he was extremely fair. So unless the Supreme Court finds almost a Trojan horse, that is, some element which enables them wriggle room, then you have to come to the next step, which is that the jury's decision is unsafe. And that's not a matter of a Supreme Court appeal court looking and saying, look, I don't agree with the judge, with the jury. It's actually, they've got to basically have come to a conclusion that is unreasonable.
It's interesting because in most other states, this matter would have been heard by a judge without a jury because of the risk of the jury being contaminated by Pell being such a high-profile figure. It's only in Victoria that it would have been put to 12 human beings.
Well, the most inflamed jury that I can remember was in Wall Street, South Yarra 2 police. Stephen Tynan and Damien Eyre were ambushed and shot dead. The men accused and charged over those matters were some of the worst crooks in Victoria, and that was played out quite publicly, and their background was well known. The state was full of emotion, and the jury heard that case, and they came back, and my information was that they believed that these people had done it, but they believed that the prosecution case was terminally flawed, which it was, and they came back and in tears found a verdict of not guilty. So they did their job, and the irony is the foreman was an ex-policeman.
Right. Very tough decision, isn't it? Who would be a juror, especially on a case like this? Alex, can we talk about the suppression order? It's a very complicated issue. The reason that the suppression order on this matter was in place was that there was another matter being considered, which was recently dropped, which is why the order was lifted. During the period of the suppression order, The Age and many other outlets published that there was a suppression order in place on a high-profile case. Why did you do that?
Well, when going back to your original question, Toria, about how difficult this story has been to cover, that's a key area in this, was how we covered the case given the suppression order was there. And all along, we had done nothing. We'd never mentioned it. And the suppression order was in place for good reason, which was why we didn't challenge the original suppression order. The suppression order was there, as you say, so that the jury for the second trial wouldn't be influenced by the first. What happened is now clearly very contentious, and we have been sent letters by the Office of Public Prosecutions to explain why we published anything at all. It was never our intention, if we have or if we haven't, it was never our intention to breach the suppression order. We tried to say that there is a big story happening that we can't report on, and explain to our readers, who many of whom would have been aware that a verdict had been reached, that we couldn't tell them anything about it. Now, whether what we did went too far is now a question that the Office of Public Prosecutions are going to have to decide. But it's a very delicate area, Tori, that is difficult actually to even discuss openly.
These decisions are certainly never taken lightly in a newsroom, though,
agonising. It was an agonising decision that went backwards and forwards and was very stressful. The fallout from that is still continuing. And I'd hate people to think that we do take any of these decisions lightly in anything that we publish. We try to be as responsible as we can be. We try to be fair and balanced. That's our just what we do. So we are certainly do not intend to be reckless in what we do in any way, shape or form. And, you know, we've taken this situation extremely seriously all the way through.
Finally, a question to both of you. Do you think the Catholic Church in Australia can survive a scandal of this magnitude?
the Catholic Church will survive. It's extremely damaged by it, but it's been damaged for 20 years or more. And when you drill down and get away from Powell, there's been a bigger conspiracy as such. There has been a number of occasions where, from certainly in my knowledge since the 1960s, where police, Catholic police, have run defence for paedophile priests. And that police who have aggressively targeted them have had their careers damaged or terminated. And that was the scandal. It was a time where across the board, police, many institutions worked on the basis, we don't want the brand damaged, so we'll hush away the problem, whether it be a paedophile priest or a corrupt copper. And the damage that's been done. So when we write a story about someone like George Pell, it's interesting and sad that some of the really aggressive responses comes from people whose lives have been totally damaged because as children they were exploited by these sort of people.
There's no winners in this, is there, Alex? It's hard to report, it's hard to watch.
It is. I think it's a really good question you ask, Tori. I agree that, you know, the Catholic Church will certainly survive, but people questioning what it means to be a Catholic as a result of this is fascinating. My wife was brought up a Catholic and I've always been fascinated by what seems to be a consistent feeling among people who are brought up as Catholics, that feeling of guilt that they seem to have on all sorts of issues. I was brought up in Church of England Protestant. I went to a Protestant school and I had to go to church every single day. In fact, I think I probably went to church 8 or 9 times a week. I was at a boarding school. But basically we went to church, sang a song, listened to someone talk about the Bible in some form or another and didn't really think any more about it. And there is definitely a difference between that being brought up in that environment and being brought up in a Catholic school environment. And I found that fascinating, and people talking about it now openly again about what it means to be a Catholic. I thought it was interesting, the Archbishop of Melbourne's homily at the weekend where he sort of compared the situation at the Catholic Church we're in at the moment to Jesus at Golgotha, if I pronounced that right, that it really is at a low ebb, and this is now an opportunity to build and restore faith in what the church is supposed to be. But yeah, I think that is another really fascinating fallout from this whole story.
And this story certainly isn't over. It's almost like we're just at the beginning of the consequences of this. So thank you so much for your time.
Just that, I suppose one of the positives, if you look at it, is that somebody of this power was actually pursued and was charged. And at some time, only a few years ago, people would have said, it's all too hard, we'll shoo it away. Mm. Now, some people say he shouldn't have been pursued and shouldn't have been charged. Regardless of what happens at the appeal, the mere fact that a jury accepted it, and he, of course, previously was committed to trial, vindicates the prosecution, even if it is overturned. There was sufficient to put before a jury, clearly, because the jury believed it.
We'll have to stop there. Thanks so much for your time and thanks for all your thought.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tori.
Alex Lavelle is the editor of The Age and John Sylvester is a senior crime writer.
This is Kate McClymont, investigative journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. Hundreds of stories every week are produced by me and my colleagues at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, keeping an eye on corruption and cronyism in politics, sport and business. And we couldn't do it without the support of our subscribers. For 50 cents a day, know you're contributing to great journalism. Search for Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald.
Louise speaking.
Hi Louise, it's Tori Maguire. How are you going?
Hi, good, good.
ABC investigative journalist Louise Milligan has spent years forensically sifting through the cover-ups and activities of Australia's most powerful Catholic leader and now convicted child sex offender, George Pell. Milligan's Walkley award-winning book, Cardinal,
The Rise and Fall of George Pell, was pulled from shelves in Victoria in 2017 and led to her giving evidence during Pell's trial. With suppression orders lifted, it will hit bookstores again on March 28 with extra details and an update on the conviction.
I'm going to start by asking you a really strange question to ask a journalist, because normally journalists are required to just, you know, be observers from the sidelines. But my question to you, in the weeks after the Pell verdict and knowing that your book is going to be back on the market, is how do you feel about this?
I'm not celebrating. You know, if there's some sort of idea out there that that's what's happening, that is not what is happening. I still feel incredibly sad about what has taken place. And I feel very sad for the victims. And they now, you know, all this time I've called them the complainants, but now a jury has found that they are victims, you know, that they have to live with this. That will certainly, the living choir boy has to live with this for the rest of his life. And, you know, compounded in his trauma about what happened with George Pell is the fact that his friend, the other victim, died, and, you know, and the tragedy behind that.
He was never able to speak for himself, was he?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. And, you know, it's just a really, really terrible thing to live with. And it is for a number of other men as well. And, you know, I feel desperately sad about it.
So just for those who don't know the full story, because there's a lot that we don't know about what happened in the last couple of years in the courts until now.
Yeah.
You wrote a book called Cardinal, The Rise and Fall of George Pell, won a Walkley.
Yes.
But it disappeared from the shelves, didn't it? When did that happen and why?
Well, it only disappeared from the shelves in Victoria. It remained for sale in every other jurisdiction. We voluntarily withdrew it from the shelves. So the timeline is that the book came out in May 2017, and the day that it came out, it had been extracted in Fairfax, as it then was.
Yes.
And so over the weekend it had been extracted. And this story, the story of the choir boys, was one of the, you know, news extracts. And on the actual official day of publication, which was a Monday, the Victorian Office of Public Prosecutions made it known in the Herald Sun newspaper that it had sent the Pell brief back to Victoria Police, and that Victoria Police was free to charge if it so wished. Now, this was after a 2-year investigation, and they do it on this day. So we then had 6 weeks in Victoria before George Pell was charged with multiple sexual offences against children, although we didn't know that at the time, because all the charges, the number of complainants, you know, the number of charges, all of that was not released and still hasn't been. At that point, we did what we had always intended to do if there were charges laid, which was to withdraw the book from publication in Victoria. But it continued to sell in other states and you know, it sold, you know, very well. There's a lot of interest in this area and in this, you know, extremely sort of divisive public figure.
So did you at any point, did you always know in your journalistic judgment that we would get to a point where Cardinal Pell would go to trial and would face these charges? Or did you think it was impossible for someone with that much power and that much cultural cachet to end up in this situation?
When I first started investigating and when I first sort of met the complainants, because George Pell had refused to fly back to Australia during the Royal Commission because he had that terrible heart condition, I was sceptical at that point about whether he would come back. When he finally was charged, I did feel that he would, because I then was very well-versed in the character of the man because I had done all the research for my book. And, you know, he's a man with enormous self-belief. He's a man who has been marked out for greatness since he was at school and, you know, had mentors in the local bishop and so on. He things have always gone his way. He's sort of a crash or crash through person. And pugilistic type of person. He's a fighter. And so I thought he probably would come back. And then the question of whether he would be, you know, convicted. In my heart of hearts, I felt that he would be. But I had no end of mansplaining, because it usually was men, to be honest, like telling me that I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, young lady, you know, you've just got no idea. This is never going to happen, you know.
Was that mansplaining about just the that culturally someone that powerful could never end up in that situation, or was it more about the facts of the case?
No, it was more about the facts of the case, which they knew nothing about.
Yeah.
I found it really irritating, but I just kind of kept plodding along. But then it became very difficult because I became a witness, and that was because there was a complainant who I was the first person that this person had told in the world about what he alleged had happened, you know, what George Pell had done, he said. So that made me what's known as the witness of first complaint. And then I became involved and I had to give evidence in the committal proceeding and all of that.
That's a very unusual situation for a journalist to find themselves in, isn't it?
It's an incredibly difficult situation. It's unbelievably stressful. But it did give me an enormous insight into what these men went through, the ordeal that they must have endured behind closed doors. And it did cause me to reflect on the fact that, you know, the law has changed in Victoria and I think other jurisdictions to mean that people who are complainants in these sort of cases give their evidence in secret. So there is no transcript. They give it off-site, so that, you know, they're not in the same room as the person they accuse. You know, no one hears it except for the lawyers and the accused and the judge. Now, that is to protect them, but I am not sure that it actually does them a service in the end, because I feel like there is no public scrutiny of what happens to them. And having seen what happened to me, a witness, quite frankly, the bullying that took place, that, you know, it was so heavy-handed. I mean, this is by a man who described George Pell's offending and apologised for this, but described it as vanilla sexual penetration.
So you're talking about his QC, Robert Richter?
Yes, I am, yeah. So, you know, for him to even think of using that phrase, even though he has a job to do, yes, he has to try and convince the court that, you know, what his client did, although he doesn't accept he did it, was not as bad as, you know, everyone thinks. A crime that when I found out the full details of, I was floored. And I totally understand now why the young man who, you know, has never revealed his identity doesn't want to, because it is shocking, absolutely shocking.
What's he told you about how he's responding to the verdict?
I don't go into the conversations that I've had with him. He's an extremely private person and he would hate to think that I was going around making representations about what has happened. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want to be defined by this experience, and he wants to keep a low profile. But all I will say about him is I would defy anyone to meet him and think that he would make this up. He is, in my estimation, a good person.
And so my final question is, do you have to update your book now?
Yes, and there will be an updated version coming out on the 28th of March. It's not, you know, it's not a, you know, a whole other book. It's just more, some more of the detail around these crimes and what has happened since the book came out. And it's in response to the enormous interest that we've had from readers. So we feel that, you know, it's only right and proper that it reflects more of where we are now.
Well, it's a very hard story to hear. I can only imagine what a difficult story it is to tell. Thank you for your extraordinary work on it. You must be absolutely exhausted.
It has been 3 years of waiting around in a lot of misery. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the direct complaints against George Pell, because I was looking at a whole culture in my book. But having said that, you know, it's a heavy burden, but it's a privilege. I admire so much the people who, you know, stick their head above the parapet and put themselves up for this ordeal, because it is a dreadful ordeal to go through and they should be applauded.
Thanks, Louise. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tori.
Louise Milligan is an investigative journalist at the ABC. Thanks to our guests this week, Alex Lavelle, John Sylvester and Louise Milligan. If you know someone who would be interested in this week's episode, make sure you share it with them. Or better yet, grab their phone and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. If you want to get in touch, you can. Our email is in our show notes. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Nicole Priestell. Technical assistance from David McMillan and Cormac Lally. Special thanks to Amelia Maguire. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.